Last week, we were introduced to this guy named Abraham, and I know if you've been to church at all in your life, you know Abraham. You've got some ideas about Abraham. Hopefully, what we talked about last week gave you a fuller understanding of who he was as a person, even before God called him. And so what we learned is that God didn't just pluck Abraham up for no reason and make him the father of not just the Israelite people, but our faith today. We all look back to Abraham. God chose Abraham for a reason. Abraham was truly able to put other people first. And that was a completely different thing from what we experienced with other people. But Abraham wasn't perfect. He did some good things. He had some good foundational kind of things about him, but it doesn't mean he was perfect. And in fact, I took it out of my notes, but I was thinking, can we just eliminate the word perfect from our vocabulary? Because none of us are perfect. Nothing that we have, everything, every one of us are imperfect people. And yet, like, we kind of still talk about this. We use this term perfect as though, like, it's not a thing. None of us can ever attain that. And the struggle with this, because so often I hear Christians, they're going to talk about sin, or they're going to talk about something, and they go, well, but I'm not perfect. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Neither am I. None of us are. And I just think, man, we just need to get rid of that word altogether. Okay, that was free today. So what Abraham wasn't perfect, because none of us are perfect. But we're going to see today a pretty big failure for Abraham. In fact, when people talk about Abraham, they usually it come up to this thing. And we just go, like, Abraham was a liar. Abraham, he was kind of a cheater. And so, like, we're like, yeah, maybe God had reason to choose him, but man, he had some issues as well. And the reality is, yes, Abraham did have some issues, because all of us have issues. Every single one of us have problems and struggles and things that we deal with. But we have to understand some really key things about Abraham and the world that he lived in when God called him. So when God calls Abraham to leave his father and his family and his future, everything that he thought he knew in this place called Ur of the Chaldees, its future Babylon, Mesopotamia, Chaldea area, God called him out of what he knew to be a stranger in a foreign land and to be a sojourner. It's called to wander in this land called Canaan. And it's a long way from home. And Abraham listened to God, and he did what he said, and he goes down to Canaan, and he begins to wander there. But there's this really interesting parallel, I think, between Abraham and Noah. The world was pretty much the same when God called Abraham as it was when God called Noah. Did you ever think about that? When you're reading the story in Genesis, like, the world is just going to hell in a handbasket and everything is going bad, but God sees this one guy named Noah, and Noah is kind of this righteous guy. And the same thing is true. Like, the stories between Noah, they come off the ark. What's the next story we read? It's about the Tower of Babel. And about everybody's going crazy and everybody's leaving and they're moving farther away from God. And then the very next thing that comes after that is Abraham. God calls Abraham. So these are very parallel stories. Through Noah and Abraham, God had a plan to save humanity from itself. Completely different plans, but plans nonetheless to save humanity from itself. Now, Noah is what we might call an insulator. Ancient people called Noah the man in the fur coat, because Noah heard God's call, but then he responded. He built the ark, but then Noah never tried to get anybody else to join him in that ark. Did you ever notice that? One of the memes you might see, or the things we hear a long time, is they say this to preachers who maybe are having a rough year, and they go, well, look, Noah preached for 100 years and nobody ever got saved. And we're like, yeah, that's true, but Noah didn't preach. Noah swung a hammer. That's what Noah did. Noah didn't preach. Noah, like, God calls Noah and he says, Noah, I'm going to destroy everything. I'm going to build this ark and you and your kids are going to get in it. And Noah went, yay, I'm safe. Everybody else is lost. That's cool. Like Noah was an insulator. He insulated himself from the world around him. He got busy doing the thing that God called him to do, and he just left everybody else. Do you ever think about that? That's pretty interesting. That's why ancient people call him the man in the fur coat, because he was okay, he was comfortable, he was warm. Everybody else was outside of that. And it really begs this question. If these are parallel stories, it begs this question. Is Abraham, when we get to him, is he going to be the same kind of person that Noah was? Is he going to hoard God all to himself, or is he going to share God with other people? Is he going to invite other people on this journey that God has called him to? I think there's something else we need to be reminded of as we get into Abraham's story. And this is something I think that we really miss, because we read the Bible with all the knowledge of we know how the story ends, and we go back and we read it over and over again, and we forget, especially with Abraham. Abraham had no law. He had no instruction booklet. He had no one to talk to when he was struggling with following God. He had nobody to talk to about, hey, I'm struggling with this. I'm just really not sure which way to go. There was nobody to kind of speak into his life. He really was on his own in his faith. Nobody really knew who God was or how to follow him. Was a completely different kind of situation from us today. And so Abraham is just, he's trying the best he can. And then every once in a while, God shows up in the story, gives him a little pep talk. He reminds him of the promise. He initiates a new covenant. Like over and over, he just kind of shows up and he gives Abraham a little bit more of the story. But God's not really giving Abraham any feedback. God is giving Abraham lots and lots of freedom. And I think the reason for that is because when we test boundaries and when we fail and when we get stuck in things trying to follow God, I think we learn more about God when we're stuck and when we fail than when we're doing everything right, when we're perfect. So we're going to jump into Genesis chapter 12 this morning. We're going to see a little bit of Abraham's failure. Here's what it says, Genesis 12 verse 10. To 15. There was a famine in the land. So God calls Abraham. He says, hey, go to Canaan, to this land I'm going to show you, and I want you to just to hang out there in Canaan. And when he gets there, there's a famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in Canaan. When he was about to enter Egypt, he stopped and he says to his wife Sarah, I know that you're a woman beautiful in appearance. And my beautiful wife is here this morning, walking. As a matter of fact, so that's nice. When the Egyptians see you, he says, they will say, this is his wife, and then they will kill me, but they will let you live. She must have been pretty attractive, right? So say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life might be spared for your sake. So here's what we get. My mom would say this. My mom would say, I have a lot of respect for Sarah. A lot of respect for Sarah. Because Sarah was apparently beautiful. Abraham, maybe not so much. He's like, look, Sarah, you're beautiful. And if somebody sees you and knows that I'm your husband, they're just going to kill me and get me out of the way and take you. So say you're my sister, that'll go well with me. We'll explain what that means in just a minute. So Abram, Sarah, they entered Egypt. The Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. And when the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Now, God called Abraham when he was 70 years old. He calls him, he says, hey, I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to bless you. You're going to have a multitude of people, more than sand of the seashore. So God makes that promise to him when Abraham is 70. A great nation would come from him. Sarah, at the time, was 60. So Sarah's 10 years younger than Abraham. And as we talked about last year, from the very early ages, everybody knew that Sarah was barren. Now, there's probably some reasons for that, and I don't need to get into it here. But Abraham knew it, Nahor knew it, everybody in their family, everybody there knew that Sarah was barren, and now she's 60 years old and still unable to have children. So Abraham gets this promise at 70, a promise that won't be fulfilled for 30 years. How'd you like to wait 30 years for God to make a promise, fulfill a promise? That's a long time. So Abraham and Sarah, they find themselves in the middle of a famine in this land that God called them to go to. Now, if you and I are Abraham and we get to Canaan and there's a famine, we're like, God, why did you call me here, God? Do you call me? Like, it reminds me of the Israelites. You call us out here in the desert just to die? What's going on? I thought you were going to bring me here and you were going to bless me and everything was going to go well for me. My life was going to be perfect. Well, I was going to be great. And now there's a famine. What am I supposed to do? So they're there in Canaan. There's a famine. They go down to the land of Egypt. They panic and they leave the promised land, just like you and I would. And so Abraham, by this time, he's already the patriarch of a pretty large household. And that household, we're told, includes his nephew Lot, his brother Haran's son. And Lot is married and has a family of his own. So in the ancient world, there's a patriarch, and then there's this whole family. It's like a triangle. This whole family, and that patriarch is responsible for everything. And Abraham is at the top of this patriarchal household now. And so this really interesting thing. Abraham has a promise from God, but he has no parameters. He has a promise from God, but God's given him no guidelines. He's given him really no direction except go to this land that I'll show you, this land of Canaan. Abraham doesn't know what he's supposed to do there. He just has this promise that he's holding on to, but he doesn't know how to bring it about. And so there's a famine, and he's a foreigner. And so he looks around and he decides that the only way I'm going to protect and provide for my family is if I leave this place where there's a famine and I go down to Egypt. Because one thing we learn about the ancient world is Egypt always has food. Because the Nile Delta, it always floods. They always have food there. Now, before they enter Egypt, this is 10 years later. So Abraham is 80, Sarah is 70, and they hatch a plan before they enter Egypt. Sarah is, again, an incredibly beautiful woman. She's barren, but she's beautiful, even at 70 years old. They need money to survive and to fulfill the promise that God has made them. So they hatch this plan. They're going to go into Egypt. They're going to tell everybody that Sarah is Abraham's sister. Now, if Abraham is the patriarch and Sarah is his younger sister, if anybody wants to marry Sarah, and everybody wants to marry Sarah because she's beautiful, what they have to do is they have to earn the favor of Abraham. So I think here's their plan, and it doesn't just come from me. Rabbi David Foreman, an actual Jewish rabbi, Marty Solomon, a bunch of people is reading and studying this. I think this is their plan. They go into Egypt, and Abraham's like, look, we're going to tell everybody you're my sister. Then they're going to kind of grease the wheels. They're going to give me, and as the patriarch of this household, they're going to give me livestock. They're going to give me money. They're going to give me food. They're going to give me stuff. And here's the way it worked back in the ancient day. If you really wanted to marry this person, you would give the family gifts. And the bigger the gift, the better the chance that you would get to marry that woman. So I think Abraham and Sarah went down there. They were going to get all of these people to give them stuff in the hopes of marrying Sarah. And then in the middle of the night, they were going to skip town. They're going to pack up their tent in the middle of the night, all the stuff that they've gotten from all these people, and they're going to leave and go back to the promised land with all this booty from it. That's not an intentional pun, but anyway, it worked. They're going to leave Egypt, they're going to go back to the promised land, and they're going to have all this stuff that they got from Egypt, which, by the way, pretty much exactly what happened when Israel was slaves and left Egypt, right? They plundered Egypt when they left. Interesting parallel there. So I think that's what's going to happen. They're going to trick people, they're going to lie to them, and they're going to keep three really big secrets. The first secret is that Sarah is married. They don't want anybody to know that, because then that would stop the flow of money. They don't want anybody to know that Sarah is barren either, because they know nobody's going to marry her. Nobody's going to want to marry her if they know she's barren. They also don't want anybody to know that they're skipping town. As soon as they get enough, they think they have enough, they're skipping town, they're leaving, nobody's going to get to marry Sarah. This was their plan. And if anybody found out any of those three secrets, like, not only would their scheme be over, but they probably would have just killed him, and that would have been the end of the story. And the plan, I think, was working really well, because Abraham's household is growing, until this guy named Pharaoh sees and finds out about Sarah. And when you're the king of the largest nation in the world, you don't have to wait for anything. You just take whatever it is you want. And Pharaoh wanted Sarah. Here's what it says in the next few verses. So Pharaoh brought Sarah into his life, into his house, and for her sake, he dealt well with Abram. Remember, that's exactly what Abraham said when he and Sarah were getting ready to go into Egypt. He said, "They will deal well with me for your sake." And so here it says, for her sake, Pharaoh dealt well with Abraham, and he had sheep and oxen and male donkeys and male servants and female donkeys and camels. By the way, this is where Abraham and Sarah get Hagar, who comes into the story later. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Again, I'm like, Israel, Exodus, so what's going on? So Pharaoh called Abraham and he said, "What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." And Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and he sent him and his wife away with all that he had. So everything that Pharaoh had given them, he says, "Just go. Just get out." Which, by the way, is exactly what Pharaoh said to Israel when they left in the Exodus. Okay, anyway. Here's a question I think that fits us. Have you ever had a plan go sideways so badly that everything you had hoped to gain gets swallowed up by how badly everything goes? You ever made a plan and you thought, man, this is going to be it. I'm going to get it. I'm going to make it rich. It's going to be great. Everything's going to be perfect. And then it just is totally eclipsed by how spectacularly horrible the plan goes and everything goes wrong. Like, this is Abraham. This little scheme that they planned when they go to Egypt goes so, it could not have gone worse for them. The only one who can, like, screw this plan up is Pharaoh, and he sees Sarah and he wants her and it's all done. Like, not only is their Ponzi scheme over, but for Abraham, like, his wife is now gone. She's gone. And Abraham, he can't fight the armies of Egypt. He can't go, like, later he's gonna go and he's gonna get some guys, he's gonna save Lot. But he can't do that in Egypt. He can't fight the Pharaoh, can't fight the nation of Israel, and he doesn't have her anymore. If he goes to Pharaoh and says, "Hey, I'm just kidding, man. She's my wife." What's going to happen? Off with his head. He's dead. And Pharaoh gets to keep Sarah. Like that, like, Abraham is completely stuck because of his plan, because of the thing that he worked out. He thought, "Oh, this is going to be great. It's going to save us from this famine." And now he's stuck in Egypt with no wife. The promise for Abraham is over. Like, he thinks, this is it. It's done. That promise that God made to me back in Ur the Chaldeans, there's no way. I can't fulfill it anywhere because Pharaoh has Sarah. Like, the only way Abraham gets out of this is if God gets involved. And thankfully, he does. God afflicts Pharaoh and his house with plagues. Again, Exodus talk. And apparently God comes to Pharaoh at some time, at a dream. We don't know exactly how, but God gets this message to Pharaoh and tells him, like, what's up? Here's what's going on. That woman, Sarah, you brought into your household, that's actually Abraham's wife. And look, bad things are going to happen to you if you keep her. You've got to give her back. And I think this is really interesting because God kind of puts the fear of God into Pharaoh. No, nobody else can convince Pharaoh to do anything except God. And God shows up in Pharaoh's life in such a way that this guy who thinks he's a god himself is now afraid. And he goes to Abraham, and it's really interesting, I think. He asks Abraham three questions in the text. Three questions that he doesn't wait for an answer for. Did you catch that? He's like, hey, why did you do this? Why did you lie? Why didn't you tell me it was your wife? And then he just sends him away. He doesn't even give Abraham a chance to answer. And he sends them away with everything that he had given to Abraham as kind of the bride price for Sarah. Like, again, the only way this works is if God gets involved. Now, something else happens in Egypt that changes Abraham and kind of helps develop and change the story. When they come out of Egypt, Abraham is kind of a different man. Because like just a few days ago, his whole world came crashing down around him. He thought he was gonna lose it. It's like, what good does it do to have all this money and all this stuff if my wife is gone and she's in Pharaoh's house? I will never see her again. I'll never be able to fulfill the promise that God had called me to. Abraham thought his life was over, and now just a few days later, not only does he have his wife back, but he has everything that he had amassed in Egypt, all the stuff that Pharaoh had given him. He leaves Egypt with everything. And then the first thing that happens with Abraham is what we looked at last week. Abraham and Lot are standing out in a field. Their flocks and herds have become too big to pasture together because of the limited resources. And Abraham gives Lot the opportunity to pick first. Like Abraham comes out of Egypt by the skin of his teeth. He's learned some lessons. And so he lets Lot pick. Abraham then takes the leftovers. But I think we get this question here. Why is Lot there in the first place? Why does the Torah even tell us anything about Lot? What difference does he make? What part does he play in the story? In fact, as you continue to read the story, Lot is going to kind of be the Achilles heel for Abraham over and over and over again. Like, you go, why is he there? Lot never should have come with Abraham. I think Abraham brought Lot with him for the same reason that he left Canaan for Egypt in the famine. Because Abraham thinks this is how God is going to fulfill his promise. See, Abraham knows Sarah is barren. He's known it all along. And Abraham thinks that if he brings Lot along, his nephew and the one he's responsible for, that God is going to make him into a great nation through his nephew Lot. Because that's the way it normally works. And that might be how things work in their culture, but that's not how things work with the Creator. See, Abraham couldn't picture a way that God could make Sarah have children. And so he's like, this is the only way we're going to get any children. Marty Solomon, he says this: Abraham takes his worst chapters and his worst mistakes in Egypt, and he turns it into a lesson. Instead of taking it and then beating himself up and letting the mistake define who he is, turning that mistake into insecurity and fear and more mistakes and more tragedy, Abraham is able instead to learn from that mistake and apply it in a positive sense in a way that allows him to continue to trust the story that God is writing. See, Abraham realizes that there's no way he gets out of Egypt unless God shows up. And he does. But you may protest a little bit. You may go, well, wait a minute. Abraham doesn't learn his lesson, because in Genesis chapter 20, Abraham again lies about Sarah being his sister. And so he hasn't really learned anything at all. So let's look at chapter 20 real quick. Now they are in the land of Philistia. They're still kind of in Canaan, but they're in this land owned by the Philistines. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife. So he's not really talking to anybody in particular. This is just what he says. She is my sister. And this guy, Abimelech, king of Gerar, he hears about this. He sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night, and he said to him, behold, you're a dead man because of the woman you have taken, for she is a man's wife. Now, Abimelech had not approached her, So he's like, he hadn't, you know, bow chicka wow wow. He hadn't approached her, okay? So so he says, Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Now, a couple of things. We notice in the story that Abraham and Sarah, they don't make a plan this time. They don't make a plan like when they went into Egypt. Abraham, I think, is just saying this. He's just saying in casual conversation, he's in a new area, a new place. He doesn't really know anybody. And he's like, hey, Sarah, that's my sister. The text says that the king, in fact, God even says, hey, I'm upset with you, Abimelech, because you took Sarah as your wife. I think what happened is Abimelech sees her. He hears that Sarah is just Abraham's sister, so he doesn't have any connection to her. He doesn't think that Sarah has a husband, like the husband is out of the picture. And so Abimelech just goes and takes her as his wife. He doesn't pay Abraham a bride price. He just takes her. And like, he does pay him off later, but he pays him off because he's afraid of God, not because he wants Sarah to be his wife. Here's what I think happened, and this is opinion based on study, okay? Abraham is now 100 years old, so we're 20 years after what happened in Egypt. Abraham's 100, Sarah is 90, and I think Sarah is showing, probably not as much as Tristan, but I think she's showing, and everybody sees that. Abimelech knows, here's this 90-year-old woman who's pregnant, like that's a miracle, and she doesn't have a husband. Like, I think Abimelech thinks she's just kind of free for the taking. We learned at the end of the chapter, though, that Abimelech is unable to father children, and all the women in the palace, wife and slave and servant and whatever alike, everybody in Abimelech's family and house is unable to conceive. I think Abimelech sees a 90-year-old beautiful woman who's pregnant, and he either takes him into his house, one, to have her son, because I think they know, they have the promise, they know it's a boy. I think one, to make her son his heir, because he doesn't have one. Or maybe, it's a beautiful woman who's 90 years old and pregnant. Like, this is not a normal thing. And so he's gonna bring her into the harem, and maybe the luck or the fortune of the gods will bless him, and the wombs of the women in his family will open up. I don't know exactly why. Maybe I'm completely off there. But we know what happens. Instead, God shows up to Abimelech and he confronts him and he says, hey, give Sarah back, because Sarah is Abraham's wife. And just like Pharaoh, Abimelech comes and asks three questions. Only this time, Abraham is allowed to answer. Here's Abraham's answer. Abraham said, I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister. We thought Abraham was just a big fat liar all this time. Abraham says, no, she's indeed my sister. She's the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. In fact, in the very next verse, Abraham says, look, when I took Sarah into my household, she and I made this pact that wherever we would go, we would tell people that she was my sister so that it would be okay, that I wouldn't be killed. Why in the world would he do that? I think because all he knows is that he has a promise that he's going to be made into a great nation. And he's afraid that if something happens to him, he loses the promise. I think that's what happened in Egypt. They get down to Egypt and they're doing all this stuff, and Pharaoh takes Sarah, and Abraham thinks, I've lost the promise. I'm not worth anything to God anymore. And then God shows up and goes, no, Abraham, look, I'm bigger than your failures. I'm bigger than your mistakes. You got yourself into this mess, but I'm going to get you out. And Abraham is learning the kind of person that God is. Abraham believed God's promise, but he struggled to trust God's plan. And over, he and Sarah try to manipulate situations that they come into contact with in their favor, and then they have to deal with the fallout. It's the same thing that you and I do. Abraham thought he was preserving God's promise, but really, he was just trying to play God himself. Again, story of my life. God, this is surely how you're working and what you want to do. God goes, no, I'm going to bring that about in a way you can't even imagine. How many times do we sit and think, oh, maybe God will do this, maybe God will do that, maybe God... God's like, no, when I do something, I'm going to blow it out of the water. You're going to not have any idea how it's coming. It happens to us today. Like, we waste more time looking for ways God might fulfill his promise than just trusting that when God makes a promise, he's already made it possible. Like Abraham, he made some mistakes. He did, because he's just like you and me. He's just trying to figure it out. He's just trying to follow God. But he made them in an attempt to see God's promise fulfilled. And I think it's reassuring to know that even when we fail to follow God's plan, I don't think God wanted Abraham to go down to Egypt. I think he wanted him to stay in Canaan. Even when we fail to follow God's plan exactly, God's patience and his grace are there to protect us as well as the promise. God gives us the freedom to fail while we learn to trust him. What do we do when we fail? We beat ourselves up. We go, how could God use me? I failed again. I shouldn't have done that, and I did it. Now I'm stuck. God's like, nah, I'm bigger than all of that. I'm bigger than all of that. Like, when I make you a promise, I'm going to make it possible, and I'm going to make a way for it to come about. God doesn't show up to us with a promise to make us into a great nation as a church. Like when we planted Real Life Church years ago, it wasn't because God showed up in a dream or whatever and said, look, I want you to plant a church and I'm going to make it into a great church. It's going to be really big and it's going to be amazing. You're going to have everything you ever wanted. But God did call each of us from the pagan places we were to trust him on a journey to a new home. He did call each of us. And together he's called us to help every person possible find real life in Jesus and look more like him every day. And like Abraham, like, we're not gonna get everything right. Stick around a while. You know, I'm not gonna get everything right. We as a church are not gonna get everything right, but we don't need to. We've just got to trust the process on the way to the promise. Because it's through that process of learning who God is and learning what he wants and how he loves us and rescues us and saves us, we learn who God is and we learn to trust the promise in that. And so the question we started out with kind of is this: Is God in the habit of blessing cheaters like Abraham and you and I? And the answer is no. God's not in the habit of blessing cheaters, but he is in the habit of rescuing people. When we get in over our heads, when we're trying to do the right thing, maybe, even when we're trying to do the wrong thing, and we get into a place that we can't get out of, we have a God that says, I got you. In the last series, we looked at it. We have a good shepherd who loves us and protects us and follows us, calling us back onto the path and back to his people. It's exciting to be here a year into our first building. And there's lots of stuff we haven't done. And it gets frustrating sometimes, but there's lots of stuff we have done. And it's better today than it was yesterday. Next Sunday when we come in, it's going to be better. But look, the building is just the building. The building isn't the promise. You are the promise. Braxton is the promise. We're the promise. That as we follow God and we try to look more like his son Jesus every day, that he's going to bring people in. Not that we would have a great church, but that we would fill heaven. That more and more people would have the hope of eternal life in Jesus. That's what we're after. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this place, but more important than that, God, thank you for these people. We see over and over again in Scripture that you call people to places, to Canaan, and call them back towards the West. You're constantly calling people to places, but it's not about the place. It's about the people that are there. It's about the kind of people that are going to be developed and the faith that is going to be grown in that place. And so, God, this place is not about this place. It's about how you are growing us in this place and growing us as a people together. So, God, thank you for loving us. Thank you for everything that you give to us. Thank you for watching over us. Each and every day, even when we get ourselves into places and situations we can't get out of, thank you for being there. In Jesus' name, amen.